can't be that technologist that just like the excitement of kind of learning something. It's okay to do the shortcuts. It's okay to learn something. It's okay to seek help. It's okay to seek guidance. I never had a board till I was preparing to sell Entrepreneur Security. I formed a board for that purpose, which was super wise. Boards are a pain in the ass, you know. I mean, it's worth the trouble.
Welcome to the Cybersecurity Defenders podcast, where we talk to the people who keep the internet safe. These industry experts share their innovative cyber defense technologies, vital insights into threats, and predictions for the future of cybersecurity. My name is Christopher Luft. I'm one of the co-founders of Lima Charlie, and I will be your host. This podcast is brought to you by Lima Charlie, maker of the SecOps Cloud platform, infrastructure for SecOps where everything is built API first. Scale with confidence as your business grows. Start today for free at limacharlie.io. Now let's get into it. My guest today is Stel Valavanis, founder and chairman of Onshore Networks and a longtime technology entrepreneur. Based in Chicago, Stel has more than 40 years of experience spanning software development, network design, and cybersecurity. Over the course of his career, he has founded 8 companies, invested in more than 10 others, and served on numerous boards. In addition to leading Onshore Networks, he was the founder of Onshore Security, which he sold to CyberMax in 2024. And he is co-founder of Blue Team Con, co-founder of The Gallery, a business incubator, and an active angel investor focused on supporting early stage companies. He earned his degree in physics from the University of Chicago and has continued to stay closely involved in both the technology and nonprofit communities, including serving as a board member of the ACLU of Illinois. Today, we'll be talking about building and sustaining a security-focused company over 3 decades, investing in startups, and how founders can think long-term about technology, governance, and growth. Stel, thank you so much for being with us on the show today. It's a real honor to have you here.
Well, my pleasure.
Yeah, to get started, I found it really interesting that you studied physics at the University of Chicago. How did that way of thinking shape how you approached technology and security today?
Well, you know, a lot of people in our space, you know, started out as nerdy kids, of course. Not everybody, but maybe most. Yeah, and it's just like you're just drawn to kind of like quickly to the complexity of things, you know, get down to it. You know, it was never good enough for me to accept things at face value. And that went through a string. And I wanted to study physics since I was like 9 or 10 years old. You know, this was like a lifelong kind of thing. So you just like you quickly find, you know, peel off the layers, you know, what you see around you in the world. And then it's, you know, biology. And then underneath that is chemistry. And underneath that is, you know, physics. And theoretically, you could say underneath that's mathematics, perhaps. That's a worthwhile question.
I was going to say my grandfather was a mathematician. He was a topologist. So I would say that you go one more layer deep.
Right. No, a topologist would say that. Not all the mathematicians would say that. Yeah. You know? I actually have an argument with my father-in-law, who also is a topologist. He's retired, interestingly. Yeah. And he actually doesn't agree, not exactly at least. Anyways, longer discussion, but I'm in that camp though, that I think that the natural laws are a mathematical outcome. So that said, what happens is, you know, you can't help but just like take things apart. I mean, I can't tell you how many, you know, stereo equipment I had to figure out to put back together, you know, of my dad's and whatnot, you know, but it was a blast. And he was smart enough. He was smart enough to get that. You know, let the kid break stuff. It's not a given that somebody has the kind of, you know, drive to really study something and learn it kind of, in its as fundamental as possible. Not everybody has that drive. And so he cultivated that. So he made me. And so going in and eventually study what I wanted to study. Interestingly, I never really fully accepted that I was kind of a businessman at heart. And a lot of that does come from my father. And I never really said, you're laughing because I bet you have the same experience. So, I mean, I was, you know, writing software when I was a kid. I was phone freaking. And it was literally about like just loving to just learn about everything in the world, how everything works. It was just like, nothing had a goal. You know, and then in high school, I started a company. My first company, I couldn't drive. I was 15. you know, again, I'm not alone there. That's a smaller set of people, I guess, of nerds kind of who do that, you know. And I was inspired by you know, the Apple guys, or my favorite was Beagle Brothers software. I don't know if you knew you were an Apple II guy at all, but, you know, so I'm older than you, so I'm in that generation. Before there were Macs, you know, before there was DOS, actually, even, you know. You know, and it was just cool, and I wrote fun software writing. Oh, they're fun friends who write software. How the hell we found each other then without the internet? I still don't even really know. It was kind of a ham radio. There was a ham radio thing. Ham radio, CB radios. Other people were ham. Yeah. I haven't gotten to that point. So that said, the way it informs me then is like I'm drawn to wanting to understand things fundamentally. I realized at some point or another that I did not internalize it for a long time, that business, that creating businesses in particular, but not just that, like building businesses, is a creative endeavor. Mm-hmm. It's a creative endeavor that employs kind of good, kind of fundamental understanding, very quickly kind of finding a path, also accepting holistic kind of thinking rather than analytical thinking all the time, so that you sometimes can see the parts of things or see the sum of things, sometimes not necessarily with the parts. That's a bunch of things to reconcile. And I just think it was in me the whole time, and I didn't really see it till a little bit later in life. And looking back, it truly informed me.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think sometimes, like, the idea of becoming a capitalist and building businesses gets a bad rap because, you know, there's a lot of what's wrong in the world that people attribute it to it. But I can also say from personal experience, you know, I think it's the best way to support a community and help people thrive is economic success, right? Like when money comes into a community, lives change and outlooks change and outcomes change. So, and I also think it is like such a, for ADHD type brain like mine, and I suspect yours, like the diversity of problems that you have to solve all the time keeps it super interesting. So I didn't set out as a technologist first. I'd say I set out as a business person first and found technology in my early 20s and kind of thrived from there. Yeah.
I mean, there's the kind of a little bit of that flip has one small difference in that from the technologist first rather than from the business first. Again, they come together 100%. I'm aligned with you in that. Where there becomes a difference when you flip the coin either way is that the kind of like the technologist, inspired technologist, or somebody who wants to really understand how everything works or learn constantly or whatever it is, or dabble or whatever, they're drawn to what's difficult. Mm-hmm. And that is amazing in many circumstances, but is absolutely a flaw in many circumstances in business. Like you have to be willing to kind of take the beaten path. You have to be willing to kind of, you know,
be a little pragmatic.
And I err on that side. Now, you know, and in fact, as an investor, I look for these qualities in people. You know, one of the things I identified, you know, very high on my list is this kind of like this duality. And let's call it like, you know, kind of, that pivot, that squirrel, you know, just jumping onto like what's exciting right then, or, you know, what's grabbing your attention, or what's a huge opportunity or something like that, versus that stay the course. Like, I see the horizon. I got my hand on the wheel. I'm going to hit the blinders or whatever. These are contradictory.
Yeah.
And they parallel the dichotomy you presented, you know, they parallel that. And, you know, sometimes you magically get those in one person, usually with experience. People can kind of like channel it and flip it, whatever. Perhaps you and I have kind of found that reconciliation somewhat, you know. But in a young person, it's hard, even harder to find. So usually, and you see it all the time, who are these, the winning kind of big, you know, whatever, venture back, whatever, this or that. It's usually a team. It's usually a couple people. And there's somebody that represents one and somebody represents the other. Whatever, Jobs and Wozniak.
I've heard it's the hacker and the hustler.
Hacker and hustler. That's right. Yes. Yeah. I don't like the connotations quite necessarily of either hacker or hustler, because hacker means a little bit sloppy.
Yeah,
Hustler means a little bit slimy. I don't know. But it's got the alliteration.
So it rolls off the tongue. Yeah, I've actually heard that expanded now to the hacker, the hustler, and the hipster, because design has become such a good point. Yeah,
I think that helps qualify it better too. I like that.
Three.
I mean, if we want to analyze it, we might come up with 10 important kind of qualities or whatever.
Sure. Yeah.
But I do want to respond to your point, though, about kind of the economics and the politics, because I think it's relevant. You know, I'm way, way on the left. OK, I'm way, way on the left socially. I'm way, way on the left financially, economically. And I get kind of called out. I'm like, dude, you're a capitalist. Shut up. I'm like, man, it's not religion for me. OK, you know, I mean, we live in the world we live in and we're doing the best we can. And honestly, for the most part, we kind of all have the same goals. Yes, there are some people that are so uber selfish that God forbid they do anything for other than their progeny or whatever.
Yeah.
Sure. But for the most part, the planet is full of people that just like want to live good lives, want to be happy, are happy to see people around them happy. You know, it's not full of misanthropes. They're the minority, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so it's like, okay, so what do you do? How do you make this work? Well, you know, let's face it. It still is the world we live in. There's things about every single way you could do the economy that has all kinds of positive and negative outcomes. So,
yeah.
You know, yeah. Should we stymie creativity? Of course we should not. You know, I don't care what you want to call the politics of that or the economics of that. Mm-hmm. Building companies, you and I have had a blast doing that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I agree. Producing that wealth gives dividends for
I'm very much inspired. My uncle in 2000 ish in the dot-com bubble, he was part of a founding team that sold a company to Cisco Systems and, you know, made an ungodly amount of money and literally lifted my parents out of poverty, helped me go back to school in my mid-20s, like changed the trajectory of so many people's lives. And that's really where I got inspired to take this path, because, you know, I don't care about a Bentley or a Rolex. It's not the motivation, but like, you know, being able to send your kids to university and buy a home and have a stable life. And like, that is profound, the difference that it can make.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. And you want to do more, you want to, and he did it with love. Like
yeah.
you want to do that too. And every single person you employ, I can't tell you how many careers I have launched, you know, I want to do bigger. If anything,
yeah.
I want to do bigger.
Yeah.
More like our cybersecurity community, there's so much to be done. Anyways, there's my whole box.
Okay. Let's get back to our questions here. So you founded 8 companies, and this seems topical with where we've been going.
Yeah.
What have you noticed is different about your first company versus the most recent one? Like,
mm-hmm.
what are the learnings across your whole career there?
Well, the first company, you know, didn't go anywhere. I was a kid. I mean, I literally didn't have a driver's license, you know? So, that didn't go anywhere just because we didn't have, let's say, any kind of guidance, you know? I mean, my dad is an immigrant and, you know, owned a bar and some apartment buildings and he did great. He never finished grade school and died a millionaire. So, you know, good, wonderful example of somebody that, you know, worked hard and, you know, so there's that there too. That's not fully a myth. Sometimes it's a myth, whatever. But I didn't really have that. And here's the thing, I didn't seek it out. And later on, you know, we go to a company, onshore, which ended up, you know, having two different exits before I departed. So I had two exits. I sold off parts of onshore twice, and I can elaborate. One, the dev shop. The second time was, a residential ISP. And then the third time is where I exited with it, onshore security. That was 2 years ago. And, since it has this long path, it's hard to think of it as, you know, whatever, you know, is it one company? Is it the multiple companies that spin out, whatnot? But I definitely saw in the subsequently that you don't really live in a vacuum. I can't be that technologist that just like the excitement of kind of learning something. It's okay to do the shortcuts. It's okay to learn something. It's okay to seek help. It's okay to seek guidance. I never had a board till I was preparing to sell onshore security. I formed a board for that purpose, which was super wise. Boards are a pain in the ass, you know, I mean, there's it's worth the trouble.
Yeah.
So most recently, there's a stealth startup I'm working on now. And I can't say more than that other than it's in the ad tech space. Instead of going and figuring out and beating my head on it and enjoying that, I'm seeking partnerships. And I'm seeking connections. I'm talking to would-be investors before I'm ready to pitch them.
Mm-hmm.
Never would have done that in the past, you know?
Yeah.
In general, by the way, I bootstrapped too, which is similar to my point. Yeah.
So what security assumptions from the early internet era have proven completely wrong in your opinion?
Well, a big one is like the motivation factor. You know, we early on, I don't know how many people kind of pushed for this, but we saw the hacker was more like a, you know, pranks and people having fun and people showing off and kind of being part of a community. I think the business world still doesn't understand it really. I think they do understand the criminalization of it a lot better because I think it kind of fits their worldview a little more. I don't think they get open source. Like, why do all these people do all this work for no pay or whatever? And I totally get it, you know, yeah. Maybe that's in politics. I don't know, but they don't get it. And so yeah, I think we had both sides, if you want to call them sides, were really, really, I think just flat out wrong about the nature of it. That the hackers messing around, whatever, having fun, were kind of flat out wrong about the kind of the monetization and criminalization, you know, of it going forward. And part of it because they didn't see cryptocurrency coming. That's probably the number one enabler.
I can preach on that subject. I'm not a fan. I feel like cryptocurrency just handed the keys to cyber criminals to create the, you know, billions of dollar industry that they run.
Yeah, and the other ways that it surprises me, that's not terribly surprising that it happened. I was surprised me that it could have happened. You know, once it was out there, you know, looking back, like, yeah, that shouldn't be surprising. But what surprises me is how big of a community can form around W3 in this. That like how many much there was of this pressure for this like Uber speculation, like that big of a chunk of our economy. And it's still a minority, okay, but a bigger chunk of economy that is willing to put so much into something so volatile, you know? I mean, it's one thing if it was just a utility,
yeah.
You know, like, yeah, and I get why the criminals don't give a crap that it's volatile.
Yeah.
I mean, I think their days are numbered, the anonymity. I mean, I think the tools now, especially with AI encoding, you know,
can unravel. Companies like Chainalysis, I don't know if you've seen those guys, we'll get there.
Hey, it's Nicole from the Lima Charlie marketing team. Many security teams deal with tool sprawl, dozens of different solutions that create gaps in visibility and slow down response times. Our SecOps Cloud platform consolidates your security stack into a unified platform where everything works together. Lima Charlie gives you comprehensive endpoint visibility and automated response capabilities in milliseconds instead of minutes, so you can stop threats before they spread across your environment. Try our scalable infrastructure for your security services for free at limacharlie.io.
So how's the threat landscape changed in ways that matter versus what's mostly marketing noise? I know there's a whole industry about scaring people nowadays.
To this day, sadly, compliance is the driver. You know, I had to wear the sales hat begrudgingly for, again, this is my fighting with my actual self, you know, and eventually I started accepting it and I started getting good at it. You know, the last, let's say, decade or so, I'm thinking in kind of longer stretches because my career is half a century at this point, you know, so almost, but, you know, in a smaller perspective. Yeah, I you know, there's a lot of fear mongering for sure, whatnot. But and I don't think the world's fully accepted this, that compliance is the driver. The market, you know, hasn't fully accepted that yet. And I do applaud our government and other governments for kind of playing, you know, that lead. I wish the SEC were stricter. I know there was a period of time they looked like they would be and move on. Not because I like these regulations. I don't want regulations that force people to do stuff. But you and I know, like, we're sitting ducks. You know, I mean, infrastructure. I mean, you know, honestly, the reason I wrote a blog about how we're actually, I'd say we're in cyber warfare. Like, no, nobody else say that. We're in actual cyber warfare right now. And the reason why I wrote this blog, it's partly to make a point, right? But I'm not totally being kind of dishonest about this. And the point is that you don't see what we might more all recognize as cyber war, only because you don't fire a shot, you know, without thinking about all the things that will happen subsequent to it. You know, if you got a big shot to take, you're going to wait for the right time to take that big shot. Now, granted, we've busted a lot of these back doors. I mean, there's no question about it. There's people, good people, smart people working really hard to kind of prevent this. But they all know there's loads and loads and loads, in the especially in the private sector, that are exposed. Mm-hmm. When we hear about yet another terrible kind of exposure or whatever, this was a backdoor through this.
You think about like Heartbleed, you know, that was, how long did that sit out there and how many people were using that?
Right. Yep. SolarWinds. I mean, total backdoor. Yeah. It was like very deliberate supply chain thing. It wasn't just kind of hacker stuff. It was a long game kind of strategy. The XZ open source project that infiltrated into SSH. That's warfare. To me, I think that is warfare. I think it should be thought of as warfare. So now as far as how that, you know, kind of changing landscape, I think that's current enough, recent enough, especially considering the little more active warfare, a lot more active warfare right now, that we need to see that as fresh. We need to not see this. Yeah. There's always kind of this stuff going on. No, I mean, you know, it's very advanced. I'll throw in AI in there too. I'm not a big, like, you know, AI like is going to kind of totally mess up cybersecurity one way or another. I mean, but definitely it's a factor.
It's changing the velocity of everything.
Yeah. I mean, I use it every day, and I'm often surprised how well I can do even more things and more things, you know, more automation and, you know, whatever. Yeah. For sure, that's finding its way. I don't think it's a complete night and day thing. Like, oh my God, cyber criminals can now sit on the beach while their bots are.
I want to sit on the beach.
I heard your last podcast, so I think you want to sit in your garden, right, like finding peach.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I was playing around with my MetaQuest the other day, trying to figure out how I can mobilize, like plug my PC in and take it into the backyard and work with that. But the neighbors might think I'm a little weird.
Okay, well why that I never stopped you before.
yeah. Okay, so you know, it's sort of along the same vein. You've seen all the hype cycles. Is AI structurally different from past cycles? You know, we kind of touched on it there, but do you think this has longevity given the sort of acceleration of technology and what you've seen, or is this just going to kind of fade into the background of the regular stuff over time?
Well, I mean, sure, you want to use that, the term structurally different. Yeah, of course. But so was the internet. So was TCP. I mean, so yes, it is definitely a very big, if you look at all the technology milestones, whatever, it's a very big one. Is it the biggest one? Maybe not, whatever. But, you know, it doesn't really change where the direction we're going, you know, and it's not like there's a fork in the road and we have to make a decision because of AI. Far from it. To me, it's a very clear path. You fully embrace AI as a tool to use, whether you're a evil dictator or you're a, you know, friendly, you know, work for nothing white hat hacker, you know, whatever it is, the whole gamut, it is a powerful tool. It's not one tool anyways, tools, and it's already had been being employed before LLMs came out. You know, it's not, you know, so yeah. I hope that's a good answer. I know that's not a half answer to you.
Yeah, I mean, I think it fits. I think it's probably faster and deeper than anything we've seen, but that's sort of every one of these waves of technology is faster and deeper than the last one. So I think we're just continuing on the exponential curve as it is, right?
So it's a whatever accelerator, logarithmic scale, whatever. So it's that, by the way, then not necessarily predicts, but perhaps implies that there's an even higher acceleration, you know, above that. I'm actually surprised we haven't seen more crazy stuff with CRISPR-Cas9, you know?
Well, I think that's probably regulation holding that back. I bet you if you went to some of the labs in places like China, where they're a little more risk tolerant, you'd see things that are a little wilder.
Great.
So talking about AI and technological development, do you think there's risk in over automating security operations? Do you think we're going to see some of this fallout when folks just try and get the robots to run the whole show?
Well, 100%. Onshore security, our strength was we developed a product called the Panoptic Sim. It was an integrated thing. Stuff you're familiar with, Zeek, Suricata, this kind of using network detection, but, very, very tightly integrated to eat off the wire kind of stuff. And I sold that to CyberMax. One of the big things arguments I would often have is to what extent we should do IDS versus IPS. Definitely being in line, I always felt was, kind of dangerous and added kind of a level of design responsibility that was not merited, especially since you can, integration to trigger, different IPS like event. That said, I would rather be up against a bot than any day.
Yeah.
I'm an attacker, pick my whatever soft target. I'll take the bot. Okay. Okay, so you got an IPS, especially if it's something that's has automated response, like an IPS. I'm like, come on, man. Just look at the DDoS multiplication things. There's guys out there they're not looking for 0 days. They're looking for new kind of ways to multiply their packets. I'm sorry, you're gonna find that in some IPS system, and you're just gonna make it go nuts, or at minimum create distractions. Mm-hmm. So So that said, you will never, literally, I'll call, forever's a long time, but I'll go with never on this one, not have human beings involved in cybersecurity defense. Maybe you'll stop having human beings on the attacking side. That's harder for me to say, hacker, or whatever, or a black hat. But on the defense side, you never, ever, ever will not have human beings sitting there figuring out what do we use, what's the design, what are our bots doing for us, what automation makes sense, what automation is dangerous. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, interesting. I would have agreed with you completely 6 months ago, but as we progress down this road, the more and more I feel like all my assumptions and biases towards this little meat suit that I live in are probably not as strong as I thought. So I think time will shake that one out. Yeah, I can't see it right now, but I've seen enough change with enough velocity that I can admit that I don't know what's going to happen. I really, really think that we're going to get to this William Gibson level sci-fi future a lot faster than anybody anticipated. So,
okay, and good and bad. Well, hey, thanks for sponsoring Blue Team Con in the past, by the way.
Again
this year, we can have that chat,
Yeah, yeah. We'll talk after. I think the belt's a little tight this year across the board. So, okay. Yeah, that's just the nature of the economy as it goes, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So going over to you sit on the board of the ACLU of Illinois. Mm-hmm. I love that. I love a lot of the social consciousness stuff that we've talked about. How do you think about balancing strong security controls with civil liberties? Because, privacy is a thing, and we know that we build these systems for monitoring, and everything's great when, people who are benevolent are in charge, but things can change really quickly, and then that infrastructure is in place.
Well, the Ben Franklin quote or something like that, those who sacrifice freedom for security don't deserve neither, or something like that.
Yes.
I don't know if I've got that quite right. Interestingly, how I started in the ACLU was because I participated in a panel discussion with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And ACLU people, they were like, it was an ACLU co-sponsored event or something like that with the EFF. And it was at Google in downtown Chicago. And guy who ran engineering there used to work for me. And he's like, Stel, come on in, talk about this. And it turned out there's people I knew, on the board, one person and whatnot. And so they invited me to help participate in this policy development and then eventually on the board. Look, the ACLU is a very kind of pragmatic organization. They are very clear about when something's truly kind of principle and and kind of the repercussions of that too. They would tell you, what we do, we sue the government. That's what we do. And, you know, it's gone both ways. In fact, there's disagreements in the ACLU. You know what a very interesting disagreement the ACLU was on the Citizens United? There was that's a big rift. I mean, us in Illinois were kind of very opposed to it, but a lot of the leadership were saying, no, nope, Citizens United makes sense, whatever. I mean, I'm still on the side I was on. But similarly, you know, with you know, things like surveillance and kind of whatever, you know, absolutely, I favor a society in a world where there's, you know, full of privacy. People completely control their own information, who they are. They have a right to be deleted. They have a right to be, you know, whatnot. That's really, and I think very few people would agree that, you know, whatever, all the things other take considered, that would be kind of the ideal. And it doesn't work that way, and we all get that too. So where do you draw that line? I am not afraid to go back on something. I'm not afraid to try something and say it was a mistake. I'm not afraid for society and the economic situation, whatever, to evolve. Okay. I just want to make sure that we absolutely recognize that the private sector is part of it. Mm-hmm. One of the problems that exists in the question you asked is, you know, and I don't know you meant to imply it, but is, you know, is, do we mean our governments or some kinds of authority that is generated socially versus private entities? Mm-hmm. And I say that for obvious reasons, you know, all the, you know, technology companies that hold a lot of our data, whatnot. So I'll conclude my answer with saying, like, you know, absolutely, we should avoid any kind of restrictions, regulations, whatnot that hinder, you know, people's, you know, personal privacy or personal freedoms, whatnot. But the reality is that we have to have some kinds of policies or regulations in place. Please realize that must include the private sector globally, too, of course.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, 100%. When I think about, like, the kind of information that gathered by advertising, online advertising, you're in the ad tech space now, you're saying, it's wild how much you can know about somebody. And if you think about all of that data being pooled and analyzed by AI somewhere, and then some, you know, maliciously motivated actor comes along and decides they want to, you know, find out all the people who have this particular view on something, you can locate them and know exactly who they are. It's kind of wild.
Sure. And it's dangerous. And, you know, and honestly, you know, are we going to get it right or wrong? You know, how about this? We're absolutely going to get it wrong. I don't care what we do, we're going to get it wrong. And we move on and we keep developing that. Okay, let's not be afraid of that. Mm-hmm. Let's not do nothing as a result, which is what's happening now.
Yeah. Cool. So we're almost at time here. I'm going to throw the last one I have for you at you. It's the one I ask of everybody that comes on the show. I think I didn't put it in the notes, so I'm going to be putting you on the spot here. It can be as wide or as narrow as you want. Do you have any predictions for the future of cybersecurity?
I think there's going to be a lot more kind of ways to compartmentalize and segment. I'm talking about both from a tooling and from a kind of a regular use perspective, you know, our own kind of data and network. What I'll tell you about the movements I'm talking about, like, you know, OpenClaw. I mean, run it locally, do your local stuff. And right now, that's just kind of in the hands of very capable people, but I think things like that filter down kind of locally. People, whether you agree with them or not, are very freaked out about their data in AI. So, you know, more locally run things. There's a new protocol out for that's adjacent to Matter, you know, Matter in the, you know, home automation stuff. That is a specifically kind of like, it's like the MCP of home automation. Well, you know, Matter kind of is, but the adjacent is specifically, you know, APIs for interacting with doorbells. And why does that matter? Well, didn't we just see a big blow up with Ring? By the way, people in the space already kind of were aware of that and saying something about it, but it didn't filter down to the wide public till we had the Super Bowl commercial with the, you know, the dog, whatever.
Yeah, that was a blunder as far as the advertising went.
I mean, well, part of it shows you kind of like, I mean, I could say, oh, what a bunch of idiots, they don't get it, whatever. You know, kind of the truth is, like, you don't know the outcomes of stuff. Yeah. You know, whatever. Good for them for trying something. Maybe they didn't realize they were sticking their necks out, but now all this stuff gets talked about.
Right.
And, you know, so I do think that's what we're going to see not, and so I'm giving you examples that are kind of consumer level, where it's like, where, oh, we'll have tools and systems and whatnot that allow us to kind of self-contain and kind of control our tools, our resources better. I do think desktop computing needs to become simpler. And I think there's some way to kind of leverage, you know, like a cloud computing model with it. But on the enterprise side, you know, read DHH, man, you know, there's an anti-cloud movement. Now, I think the cloud is awesome. You move fast. You don't risk capital. You don't need all this kind of as much kind of leadership engineering, but it's expensive. It's expensive in certain circumstances, which are growing. And certainly as you kind of reach some maturity level. So the turn, I own a data center. Here, I'll let Entre Networks is a data center company. So let me know if you want to talk about something like flexible, built, purpose built, whatever. I think you're going to see stuff like that. I don't know the form it's going to be ultimately. It'll probably have many forms. But that changes cybersecurity too. So I do think you're going to see kind of the need for service companies and products to be able to kind of work localized. I'm not saying necessarily the cloud kind of goes away, but more on-prem options, more ways, at least very clear guardrails. I don't know if the compliance world will follow with that. I mean, honestly, if the Pentagon had their way, it would have been all like that in the first place. I mean, they came in screaming to the cloud, as they should, you know, but that said, they went to the cloud with good, clear guardrails, right? GovCloud, right? So, So I think there is actually the kind of the pieces are there for a much more kind of, not an isolated world, because everybody loves the communication that we have, the integration, global supply chain, all this stuff. No, nobody wants to lose that, but there is a way to do it. And so now you're going to see a whole new breed of, I think, product companies, both on the consumer side and on the enterprise side that respond to my point.
Yeah, I love that too. I'm a big advocate of edge and far edge computing. My uncle early on told me he sees technology, it's like a pendulum. You know, we swing towards this like mainframe cloud thing, and then we're back to the endpoint. And I think we are in this moment where we're trying to push all that compute, and we'll see AI get closer because the latency is going to be tiny, and we'll get models on smaller chips and stuff like that. So yeah, super exciting time.
The curious one for me will be if that happens with the autonomous, you know, vehicles, because right now they're for self-contained, but ultimately as they become ubiquitous, they need to talk to each other.
Yes.
So they can talk to each other centrally, which clearly has a security risk, but has other benefits.
Yeah.
I mean, latency is a factor, and there's been talk about edge computing, like at the 5G wireless guy. There's some whatever. I don't know, some ARM chip. You know, devices in there. I don't,
I feel like one day too, there'll be no more stoplights. Cars will just whip through those intersections with the timing just perfectly done. So,
And I think that's so many awesome things about that. But it ain't just going to happen because there's all kinds of negatives too. So,
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for talking with me today. This was a fun one. It's really great to meet you. And hopefully we'll figure out something with Blue Team Con.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, talk to me. Let me know when you're, you know, what you're thinking. Okay.
All right. Yeah. Take care, sir. Thanks.
Bye, buddy.
And that brings us to the end of another great conversation. You can support our show by sharing your favorite episode with a friend, subscribe, give us a rating, or leave a comment on your favorite podcast platform. If you want to be part of the conversation, you can join our community forum at community.limacharlie.io. Thanks for listening in, and we'll see you on the next one. The Cybersecurity Defenders podcast is hosted and produced by Christopher Luft. The show is co-produced and edited by Sam Blake, with graphics by Amr Al-Khatib. Sponsored by Lima Charlie, scalable infrastructure for your security services. Visit limacharlie.io to get started for free.